Okay, everybody. I think we will get going. Firstly, welcome to this LSE Ideas event to look at, I think, a deeply significant problem, which is not going to be resolved very, very easily, which is looking at Brexit, Britain, and the Irish question. My own interest in this is both academic and personal. The personal interest is that I lived in Belfast between 1972 and 1994. I was teaching then at Queen's University in Belfast, and so lived through the troubles and then began to see the ending of those troubles leading to the Good Friday Agreement in 1998, a most unexpected development, by the way. In spite of what people think now, it was a very tough road to that peace, 10 years to get there. So my first interest is therefore very personal. Secondly, it remains academic because I continue to maintain a very great interest in Ireland, both north and south. I recently gave a talk very similar to what I'm going to give tonight on the impact that Brexit is having on Ireland, both north and south. And you've got to look at both parts of the island. I wrote a book with my wife, who is not here yet, but hopefully is coming, with a man called Adrian Gelker, who's one of the co-authors of this pamphlet. Adrian was a good friend of mine, still is a good friend of mine, and lives in Northern Ireland and is an emeritus professor at Queen's University in Belfast. So I have lots of interest in Ireland, and I'm also happen to be director of ideas here with Christopher Coker. I'm also delighted to welcome along Michael Burley, who will be speaking this evening. Michael is a distinguished author, prize-winning author, I should say, and is joining us here in Ideas as what we call our first Engelsberg Chair, which is funded by the Axe Johnson Foundation in Sweden. So, Michael, welcome this evening. The way it's going to go tonight is we're going to be fairly informal, but I'm going to use some PowerPoints. I hope you don't mind. Death by PowerPoint, but I hope not this evening. Anyway, it's largely because when people say to me, where's County Antrim? It's very difficult to point out where County Antrim is unless you've got a map in front of you. And they say, who's Arlene Foster? Well, you may know who she is, but you may not know what she looks like. So I thought it quite useful to have some photographs on the wall and a few maps, and maybe also to outline what I think are some of the problems which have arisen as a result of Brexit and its impact on Ireland. It doesn't need to be said, and it certainly doesn't need to be stressed, that when people voted to leave the European Union back in June 2016, nearly 3 years ago, I just wonder how many people thought about the Irish question. I would probably said about none. And how many of those who advocated Brexit as a solution to Britain's problems or the UK's problems thought about the Irish question? I'd say probably none. In other words, I mean, this is almost a classic case, if I might say so, of a kind of an English-made, and it is an English-made because Brexit is a very English thing, I think. It's an English-made problem which has landed up in Ireland. In other words, yet again, if I might put it, and I'm not anti-English, obviously, given my accent, but the damned English have yet again screwed up in Ireland, to put it rather bluntly. Now, I know there are many out there who might take a different view to the one I'm going to express this evening and say there's a simple technological solution to the Irish border question. But anybody who knows anything about Irish history and the way that border was first drafted back in the 20s knows that there's no such thing as a technological problem to the Irish border, because the Irish border is more than just a border of technology. It is a symbol. It's a significance. And after all, a 25 to 30 year war was fought by the Provisional IRA in order to get rid of that border. And so one can see how the depth of feeling is on many sides about it. So for many, many reasons, I wanted to kind of have a hope and intelligent discussion tonight with Michael and with yourselves, thinking about the new Irish question, if that's the way to put it. So forgive me for my PowerPoints. I'll try and speak as quickly as possible. Look, you don't need to go back to the whole business. Here it is. There's the original 75 referendum. Overwhelming yes, we know it was for a different kind of Europe. Moving on very, very quickly, here's the vote, obviously, in 2016, answering that very basic question, should the UK remain a member of the European Union or leave it? And, of course, as you can see from this, pretty clearly a large part of England decided that it wanted to leave. Some parts of Welsh Wales, Cymraeg, decided they wanted to remain. Very interesting relationship between Welsh language and played Cymru, by the way, and remaining. Obviously, London decided, and I'm not going to go through all the details, but more obviously, Scotland decided to remain. But actually, most people were looking at Scotland at first, by the way, when they kind of thought of the United Kingdom or the disuniting kingdom and the impact it might have. But very few at first began to think about what it's going to mean in Ireland or on Northern Ireland. Yet, over the last year at least, and certainly a bit longer, the Irish question and the question of not just the hard border, but the impact that Brexit, or even a hard Brexit, to take it even further, is going to have on this particular part of the United Kingdom, and indeed on the whole of the United Kingdom. Here's a very simple map. It just outlines it. It's a pretty awful map, I'm sorry. But Scotland are clearly voting Leave. And by the way, so did Northern Ireland. So what I'm going to do, very, very simply, is take us through seven quick steps. They'll be as quick as possible. One, I'm just going to look at how the vote on Brexit worked out in Northern Ireland. Why did the people of Northern Ireland vote Remain? You've got that contradiction, essentially. 56% of the people in the North voted to remain. But it was a very deeply divided vote within the North. I mean, that's the point to make. In other words, it exacerbated division within the North of Ireland in a part of the world where divisions come pretty naturally, and one did not want to exacerbate those divisions, but those divisions have been consolidated and reinforced, of course, by the referendum and the outcome of that as well. I'm going to look a little bit at the DUP. I'm bound to do that, of course, because that's the dominant unionist party in Northern Ireland, not only the dominant unionist party in Northern Ireland, but now holds, if you like, the balance of power at Westminster today by extraordinary miscalculation by the current Prime Minister back in 2017 when she thought she would enhance her majority in the House, and in fact it went down and therefore became dependent on the DUP. And that again has exacerbated the problem, because as you all know probably by now, the DUP is hard Brexit, with one exception, by the way. There's a couple there. Even the leader of the DUP may be softer on that particular issue. But again, that's added in a further dimension. I'm going to look very briefly at the Good Friday Agreement. It's not about to fall down. It's not about to collapse, I don't think. Yet, nonetheless, it is at risk. There's no doubt. Because I think the Good Friday Agreement presupposed the UK and the Republic of Ireland being members of the European Union. People often forget that dimension of the peace process. You can look at Tony Blair's role, which was admirable, by the way, in my view. You can look at Bill Clinton's role in it as well, which I think was extremely positive overall. You can look at what happened within Northern Ireland as well, and some of the decisions that many took, both on the Republican and on the Unionist side. But nonetheless, the framing for the Good Friday Agreement was the very simple fact that both parts of Ireland, North and South, members of UK and Republic of Ireland, were members of the European Union. And this was almost built into the Good Friday Agreement, so you can see why many people are very worried about the future status of the Good Friday Agreement, given that the Good Friday Agreement assumed many things, but one of the things it took as a given was that both the London government and the Irish government, Dublin government, would actually be members of countries which were members of the European Union. So it's not silly to talk about the Good Friday Agreement. Then, of course, this brings up the border question, which leads us then to the so-called backstop, which has been discussed at great length over the last few weeks and months. I'm going to mention briefly about Sinn Féin and Brexit, which is very, very interesting. Because as you probably know, within Northern Ireland today, the dominant part, actually, the peace process has actually rewarded the extremists, if that's the way to put it. Because it started with the official Unionist Party, it started with the SDLP, to some degree with the Alliance Party. But basically, in a period of peace, the two big blocks on either side become the two big blocks. One's called the DUP, the Democratic Unionist Party, founded by the Reverend Ian Paisley back in the 1960s. And, of course, Sinn Féin itself. So Sinn Féin is an important player in this, and I want to say something briefly about that. I'm going to talk very quickly about the economic impact. Overall, there's been a lot of talk about how Dublin is going to benefit from London's financial demise, or London's financial difficulties will become Dublin's opportunities. And there's no doubt there are some opportunities there. And who can blame the Irish government for trying to seize those opportunities, the same as in Frankfurt or Amsterdam or elsewhere. So Dublin is well situated from that point of view. But I would still want to make the argument that the impact economically on the South is going to be very, very damaging indeed, particularly, and on the North as well, by the way, if there is indeed a Brexit, a deal of any form, and indeed a hard Brexit. And then finally, I'm going to talk about diplomacy, because that's what I teach a little bit on international relations. I think this whole thing has been a diplomatic disaster for the British, by the way. An absolute diplomatic disaster. The Dublin government has been extremely adroit, I put it like that, at building its diplomatic support networks in order to reinforce its own position. People kind of say, well, you know, I always had a great admiration, by the way, for the Irish Foreign Service. If anybody knew about them, you knew. This is a very admirable and extremely... Douglas Hurd used to talk about British Foreign Service or Britain punching above its weight. Well, I always say to people, go to St. Stephen's Green, go there, and you'll find there's some very, very bright and extraordinarily able people there. But nonetheless, notwithstanding the quality of the Irish Foreign Service, the truth of the matter is that Britain suffered massive diplomatic defeat over this whole question. So it's a wider international issue, not just one connected to the 26 counties or to Ireland as a whole. Okay, very, very quickly then, just to run through it for you. The vote within Northern Ireland itself is from these simple figures you can see, and I'll give you a couple of maps in a moment. These are the figures, 89%, 88%, 85% of those calling themselves nationalists, Irish and or Catholic, or all three put together, and nonetheless voted overwhelmingly to remain. It's an overwhelming vote to remain within the European Union. The Unionists, Protestants, whatever phrase you want to use to describe the majority within Northern Ireland, were much more evenly divided in the vote, but nonetheless, as you can see from these figures, only 35% of those describing themselves as Unionists, 38% of those identifying as British, and 41% of Protestants voted to remain. So in other words, the divide within Northern Ireland along communitarian lines was also reflected, not perfectly, but was reflected in the Brexit vote. In other words, nationalists, Republicans voted overwhelmingly to remain within the European Union for all sorts of interesting reasons we can discuss. Whereas the Unionist Protestant population voted not so overwhelmingly to leave, but certainly voted in numbers to leave. And I've got a couple of maps here. I love these maps, by the way. This, of course, is the east of... What's that? No. Can we get rid of that? Sorry. Okay, fine. Sorry about that. So if we look at this map here, basically, if you want to put it in rather crude terms, the closer you get to the Irish border, the more nationalist and Catholic and Irish it becomes. And the closer you get to the east of Northern Ireland, the more Protestant and Unionist it is. So when you take a county like County Antrim here, going down to parts south down around here, about Porter Down, and then onto Ards Peninsula, overwhelmingly, that's where, if put it rather crudely, that's where most Protestants will live, in and around the eastern part. And you can see from this, therefore, just on a simple map, that the overwhelming majority of nationalists, Republicans, Catholics, whatever term is used, I always get confused on that one, even after 25 years of living there. You can see how overwhelmingly the nationalist vote went to remain, and the blue vote, which is the Protestant vote, went to leave. This is an even better one. This actually maps out national identity in Northern Ireland. So the more blue, the more British, and the more green. And it's not too subtle, is it? The more green, the more Irish, if you want to put it like that. And again, you can see that national identity. Here defined by religion, broadly speaking, corresponds quite clearly to the way the vote broke down within Northern Ireland. Again, you'll find a few differences here, but overwhelmingly, the more British you were, the more likely you were to vote, to leave. The more Irish you were, and more close to the Republic of Ireland, Donegal, Cavan, etc., the more likely you were to remain. And again, you see the same kind of thing over there. This brings out again same kind of thing. In other words, the first point I want to make very simply is that the Brexit vote in Northern Ireland not only led to a Remain vote in the north, in the six counties, but clearly divided Northern Ireland, broadly speaking, along sectarian lines. Not completely, not clearly. A large number of Unionists clearly voted to remain, and they have become an important part of the debate within Northern Ireland, particularly amongst Protestant businessmen, who think they're going to lose out very badly indeed, and businessmen more generally, in a bad Brexit or Brexit at all, and certainly a no-deal Brexit. So that's the first thing I want to make. The second point I want to make is about the Democratic Unionist Party. I'm not going to go back into the whole history of the rise of the DUP. But they've become the dominant representative party of the, basically the Protestant Unionist vote in Northern Ireland. That might not have mattered too much, except Mrs. May, in her wisdom, decided to call a general election in 2017 in order to, I suppose, red scare people into voting more for the Tories, because they thought that Corbyn would be such an electoral disaster and a liability for the Labour Party. It didn't work out quite like that, as you know. And therefore, as a result of another political miscalculation, it therefore left the DUP with a clear, if you like, the kingmakers or the queenmakers with inside the UK Westminster Parliament. Nobody could have predicted that. Nobody would have anticipated that. But nonetheless, that is how it came out. So you've got two things working here, problematic. One is the vote itself within the North and the way it divides the North. And secondly, the way in which, by coincidence, almost perfect storm politically, in which the vote of 2017 leaves the DUPs in a very, very strong position, extraordinary position, one they would have dreamed about. I'm not sure they could have even dreamed that they would have so much power and influence. And by the way, it's not the first time in British political history where unionists have played a big role in Westminster politics. If you go back to the years of Major and others and things like that under Good Friday Agreement, doesn't it? What's the DUP in politics for? Well, I mean, many, many things, no doubt. But clearly, put it in political terms rather than going into the cultural aspects of their opposition to gay marriage and the rest, their fundamental thing is to preserve the union with the United Kingdom and prevent a united Ireland. And it's become, or made a tactical alliance at least, in the British Parliament, in the UK Westminster Parliament, with the European Research Group, who support a hard and even a no-deal Brexit. And together, they have opposed the May EU agreement, which they claim. And time and time and time again, the European Research Group and others said, we will only go if the DUP goes. Now, whether that's more tactical than deeply ideological is another question, but you can see the weight that that gives to a small group within the Westminster Party. It's quite an extraordinary position for them to be in, to be perfectly honest. Now, I'm not going to say anything about the individuals inside the DUP. I've got my own personal opinions about a few of them. Some are not too bad, some are pretty awful. But nonetheless, that's the situation. Here they are, gathered together. Here's the team. One, two, three. There's Sammy Wilson, former mayor of Belfast, when told that there might be food shortages following a breakdown in relations with the EU. He said, don't worry, you can go to the chippy. Which was a very Sammy Wilson thing to say, by the way. This is Nigel Dodd, lawyer, Northern Ireland. Obviously, you go down the line, Donaldson and a few others. So, there he is. That's Owen Paisley's son, of course, the youngin'. So, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. The leader, by the way, is the leader of the party, but she's not a member of parliament. But this is the group of DUP with that rather important role that they're playing. And Geoffrey Donaldson is always looking very, very self-important anyway. He's looking even more pleased for himself there, I think, it seems to be. Anyway.
Sir Geoffrey,
I do beg your pardon, sir. I'll write to Geoffrey and apologise. What is quite interesting, however, just quickly, what is quite interesting about the DUP is, while they're the kingmakers at Westminster, in Northern Ireland itself, their role at Westminster has come under severe attack. And it's not just come under a severe attack from, you know, what you might call the usual suspects, the Republicans, Nationalists, Alliance voters, the few who have remained, you know, and others. It's also come under quite a lot of attack from Protestant business people worried about a hard Brexit, and a fear that a hard Brexit is going to have some very negative economic repercussions within Northern Ireland itself. There have been a number of reports coming out of the Northern Ireland business community that they're extraordinarily worried about a hard Brexit. And, Arlene Foster is not exactly the most popular politician in Northern Ireland from those of a Catholic background. But this was an Irish Times poll, so you might say, well, they're damn biased, they come from Dublin and all that. But nonetheless, I think it looked like a fair poll in terms of measuring the kind of ways in which what happens here in Westminster is not what's going on over there in the North. And one of the things I've constantly been annoyed about is listening to the DUP at Westminster. Okay, they've got the absolute right to express their own opinion, but nobody tells us what is going on over there and how things in the north of Ireland, Northern Ireland, are themselves being represented. And we don't get the view from within. We've had a bit, but nowhere near enough. It's a different story when you go to Northern Ireland. So, and not just, as I say, on the Irish National Catholic side, but also a very large numbers of Protestants worrying about their jobs, Protestant businessmen, Protestant farmers on the border,
very worried about a hard Brexit and all it may mean. Business in Northern Ireland has been forecast to be hit very hard with a hard Brexit. It could be hit very hard indeed, as would Ireland overall. There was a 2019 government report that a no-deal Brexit would affect the viability of many businesses across Northern Ireland and warned that some businesses would relocate to the Republic of Ireland. To which, of course, Sammy Wilson yet again said, no, they won't. Sammy's not an economist, you know. The question of the Good Friday Agreement, the next parties want to deal with, again, the agreement assumes continuing EU membership, but it binds neither explicitly. But it nonetheless does assume it. Yeah. The three strands of the agreement, there's no doubt about it, the three strands of the agreement built into that an assumption that both Britain and Ireland would be members of the European Union. And by the way, Michael will talk about this at length, the role the EU played very concretely in the Northern Ireland peace process, and economically as well, particularly Monsieur Barnier himself. But it's an interesting footnote on all that. So, strand one of the Good Friday Agreement pledges close cooperation between the UK and Ireland as, quote, from the Good Friday Agreement, partners in the European Union. Strand two of the agreement, continuing UK-Irish membership is assumed, and strand three suggests EU issues possible discussion for British-Irish Council. So you see, it's there. It's built into the Good Friday Agreement. That is why people are worried. It's not just scaremongering. You know, it's not just Operation Scare. It's actually there because this extraordinary agreement, which has lasted for the better part of 20 years, has one of its underlying assumptions, as Adrian Goldke particularly points out in his pamphlet, is about that. This is what's happening along the border. You get all along the border now, quite a lot of these, it must be Newry, I think, coming into Newry, I don't know where. No EU frontier in Ireland, no hard border, respect the Remain vote. Again, you can see the impact this is having. And this is all the way along the Irish border, but, you know, right from the coast up to Donegal, you know, to northern Donegal. So again, you can see it's repoliticizing the border question. I mean, in a way, what the Good Friday Agreement was designed to do is to take the border out of Irish politics. It won't go away, but just to take it out of the politics, to detoxify it. And in again, as a result, we've seen a retoxification of the border question and a greater danger arising as a result, because the symbol of the border isn't just a technical issue. And this, of course, then leads to Brexit. It then leads to the question, as you know, that if there is you know what's going to happen, essentially, it's now a border. It will become a real border between two countries. They no longer have an easy movement of goods or peoples or whatever. You simply have to put a border there. Because that's the regulatory and legal need from the EU's point of view. Because you can't just have things moving across borders. If the border now becomes a genuine and real border, and of course in turn, that leads to this backstop solution, which you heard so much about recently in the British debate. The backstop, in a way, is the solution to try to make sure there's not a hard border. But the backstop, and again, this adds to further toxification of the situation, the backstop itself then means that either the north of Ireland, Northern Ireland, or maybe the whole of the UK become part of the customs union to prevent a hard border. You can then imagine the impact this is both having on the right wing of the Conservative Party, the ERG people, and, of course, on the DUP, who see this as the kind of sleight of hand to kind of separate the north from the UK, to put a border, not across in Ireland, but a border down the Irish Sea itself. And you can see again how that's played such a big role in preventing a deal. I'm not saying it's the only factor which has prevented Mrs. May's deal going through, but it's assumed of an importance, which again nobody could have ever predicted. Once again, we come back to the backstop. If only they could get the backstop sorted out, we might be able to have got a deal through with Mrs. May. Well, whether that's true or not, it's another bigger question, much larger issues involved. But you can see how central it's all becoming now. You know what's wrong with the backstop from the point of view of the DUP. They just don't like it because they think it's toxic. There's a quote. The current backstop is toxic to all of us living in Northern Ireland, says somebody from the DUP. Indeed, for all units right across the United Kingdom, because it would cause the breakup of the United Kingdom in the media. That's the kind of fear and worries and concerns, genuine or otherwise. So, On Sinn Féin quick, and I'll hand over to Michael. This is just background for you. Michael can then give you the Mick Jagger version. He'll come up with it. I'm just bread and butter. He's going to be Mick Jagger. It's very, very interesting. The Sinn Féin actually got seven seats. But of course, Sinn Féin policy is not to sit in a UK parliament because you have to declare an oath of loyalty to the crown. And actually, Fane's history is actually about not declaring loyalty to any British crown. They're not going to sit there. Ironically, actually, if they'd sat in the UK Parliament, which was constitutionally for them impossible, it may have made a difference. It certainly would have brought an Irish voice into the debate on the Westminster floor. But they refused to do so. Yeah. The thing I think, my own take on this is, I think Sinn Féin's doing quite well out of the Brexit crisis. We can come back to that in a little while. I mean, they didn't manipulate it. They didn't want it. Actually, they supported Mrs. May's deal. They support the backstop, obviously, as well. But so I think actually they could be becoming the political winners in this within the Irish context. So we can come back onto that again. Quickly, the economic impact on Brexit and Ireland. I'm not going to go through it all. Very simply, report after report on report suggests the negative downside of the impact on Ireland and the UK. UK is a land bridge to continental Europe. The economic dependency of Ireland on the British market, on the English market, is huge, etc., etc., etc. And, you know, if there were all sorts of other problems coming out of it, it seems to me the Irish economy would suffer. And that is certainly the view of most of those who've been writing about this in Dublin for quite a long time. Again, I'm not going to go through all this because it simply repeats what I've just said. There is an argument, however, there's one argument, which is, does it also present some economic opportunities for Ireland as well? And I think there's a double-edged sword to this Brexit thing for Ireland. I think it might, but largely in the financial services and largely for Dublin. I think for farmers and for those in other industries in Ireland, it's going to be, I think, a real problem. Mm. And especially a no-deal Brexit would be for both the North and for the South. But there is this kind of, and you know, 27 firms have committed to moving staff to the city since the rest. So you can see Ireland actually is ahead of Frankfurt, Luxembourg and Paris. And you understand distance, language. And the Irish people are very nice people, you know, so you know what I mean. Dublin's a very fine city, so it's not a bad place to go and live. So there is an economic upside to all this, although I think one's got to take into account basically the real. And here's a quote from the Financial Times. We are very pleased with the diversity of institutions that have chosen Ireland as a place to do business because of Brexit, says Michael Darcy, Minister of Financial Services. I'm not going to go into too much detail now. You get the double-edged sword, but I think overall my message is, in a sense, it's a downside. Whatever certain specific sectors like finance might benefit. Final point, and then we go to Michael. There's no question. I mean, I think whether it's not just the EU has gone into standby plucky little Ireland against the perfidious Brits. It is that Ireland has also, I think, played a pretty sharp, clever diplomatic role here in bringing the EU, EU-ifying it, and indeed, by the way, Americanifying it. Mm. They've internationalized it very skillfully to isolate the UK government. Whether the UK government fully realise they are as isolated as they really are, I don't know. Michael, you may have some thoughts about that. Michael Barnier said it very quickly. The EU will stand fully behind Ireland. Not just because Ireland is a member of the EU, therefore you defend one of your own. It is also for other reasons as well. I've always made this. The impact on Anglo-Irish relations, I think, have been very deleterious. You know, we know the history of British relations with Ireland. The Good Friday Agreement back in the 1980s, even going back to the Anglo-Irish Agreement of 85, when I was living in Belfast, I remember going to a demonstration, and I suddenly found myself surrounded by members of the UDA, the Ulster Defence Association, saying, proud to be Protestant, and down with the Anglo-Irish Agreement. It was quite fun. I got out of there as quickly as possible. But nonetheless, there wasn't, to get to the Good Friday Agreement, you need a major improvement in Anglo-Irish relations. You know, part of the Good Friday Agreement is a product of improving relations between London and Dublin. And, you know, and thank God too. You wouldn't have got where you got to without extraordinary levels of cooperation between London and Dublin. And much of that now, it seems to me, has been thrown into the air. Because they've been simply sitting on two sides of the diplomatic table. And this to me again is a really big downside effect of the Brexit agreement, this diplomatic fallout, which is doing nobody any good, but it's there, and it's almost a structure built in. Ireland has lots of support in this, Mr. Vardica. There's Barnier and there's Mrs. May. Somebody said you couldn't get into Dublin sometimes because there's always somebody important from Europe visiting. Week after week after week, you couldn't get so many, European EU leaders were going to Ireland to pledge their support. And I end on one particular note, the Americanization or the American factor in this. Don't forget it. Bill Clinton was a crucial player in the Good Friday Agreement of 1997-98, and a very fine role I think he played. I'm an unapologetic supporter of Clinton on the Northern Ireland question. America takes a very strong interest in the Irish question for all sorts of historical and cultural reasons. There's a certain natural sympathy, let's put it rather broadly, very broadly, carefully, but to a nationalist position, not necessarily a Republican position, but nonetheless there is. And, well, you don't need to be told who this lady is. Here, Nancy Pelosi, on her visit to the UK, she went over to Ireland, and I came across this. And this is a very interesting statement. "Let me be clear," says Nancy Pelosi, probably the most powerful woman in America today, by the way, for obvious reasons. "If the Brexit deal undermines the Good Friday Agreement, of course, there will be no US-UK trade agreement." And she has the power to make that true. So I'm going to end there. Thank you very much for listening. I'm now going to pass over to Michael to continue the conversation. Michael, over to you. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Mick, thank you very much for, first of all, appointing me to this new chair. I'm not sure what to make of the comparison with a rock star who's 10 years older than me.
Oh, but he doesn't.
Anyway, when I was asked to do this, I saw that one gentleman in Queen's University Belfast and the other one in Dublin had written respectively about the Irish Republic and then about Northern Ireland. So I was essentially asked to talk more in my contribution about England, Brexit and Ireland, which is what I'm going to do now. Now, normally, I guess in the last 20 years, given the subjects most of my books are about, I've ended up spreading a sort of pervasive gloom throughout every room I've ever talked in. And I thought tonight I'd break the habit of a lifetime by looking for some ray of sunshine. And I found one, actually, amidst all the Brexit gloom. I would say there's probably more interest in the EU, in Britain, right now, than any time since we joined the EEC in 1973 and then voted overwhelmingly to remain in it 2 years later. In fact, the first time that I ever exercised the right to vote. It's generated not just that interest, but also almost a sort of addictive, obsessive concern with it. So in the last 3 years, I've had to, because I follow it every day for professional reasons, I've learned about the Chequers deal, the backstop, the backstop to the backstop, the Brady Amendment, the Malthouse Compromise, Cox's codpiece, and then WAB. Although apparently if we don't have a Prime Minister after tonight, there won't be any WAB. So there's this extraordinary sort of arcane jargon that you have to learn about. The other upside, I would say, speaking as an Englishman, is that there's also a heightened interest in the constituent parts of the UK and in the neighbouring independent Irish Republic, though I suspect in many cases that doesn't extend to really grasping the fine differences between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. Simon once told me a tremendous joke about it, but I doubt whether he's going to repeat it in this company. Yeah, he'll repeat it later, he says.
Over a drink, I think.
The Brexit decision, I think, something that Mick said, which I'd like to also very much endorse, and I did so actually in an interview with RTE last year or the year before. The Brexit decision is often called an example of national self-harm by its opponents in Britain, but rather like collateral damage, it's important to remember it has deleterious effects on our Irish neighbours, especially, of course, in the border areas both north and south, which are highly economically interdependent. And they are entirely innocent victims of what was an English and Welsh decision. Now, that partly reflects what I've just said, partly reflects what one of the other contributors, Paul Gillespie, says is an enormous asymmetric divergence of mutual interest between the two countries. One's bigger, one's smaller. Irish people know a great deal more about the British than the other way round. They can read Irish editions of the Daily Mail, of the Times, etc., the Sunday Times, with specialised Irish coverage. And a large Irish diaspora in this country, of course, regularly reports home on what they see and hear here. By contrast, I live in Vauxhall. I have to go into Soho to Old Compton Street to pick up a copy of the very excellent Irish Times, because none of my local newsagents sell it. Similarly, Irish intellectuals, like their Scottish cousins, have a much more nuanced grasp and conceptual equipment to grapple with identity issues that the English are just beginning to get to grips with themselves. You just have to, in fact, you have to read a very eminent Irish writer, the Irish Times journalist Fintan O'Toole, for what amounts to a psychoanalysis of the English, which he recently published. Now, I want to turn now to Brexit. Those who, for 30 years, and I can remember one of the, I left the LSE 24 years ago, and one of my older colleagues, in fact, was one of the founders of UKIP in the history department, I seem to remember. Alan Sked.
Alan Sked.
Good God. Anyway, those who for 30 years have lobbied for the British to leave the EEC come EU do not seem to have imagined, and that's a word I think should resonate in your heads, they didn't imagine how that would impact on Anglo-Irish relations. In other words, the EU country with which we share a land border, which Mick's just alluded to, and with whom the UK was jointly involved in the crafting the intricacies of the 1998 Good Friday Peace Agreement, which is as subtle as a sort of very expensive watch inside. They didn't imagine either, just to get away from Ireland for a minute, that after the Scots were assured in 2014, that if they voted for independence, they would lose their EU membership, chiefly because the Spanish government, because of Catalonia, would block their automatic sort of easy transition back into the EU, or they'd never leave it. But then they found in 2016 that they were being prized out of the EU, which they'd been told, you know, to watch it or you're going to be leaving it, they were then prized out of the EU by English and Welsh voters in 2016. And no wonder they're very, very angry about it. Now, as Mick just alluded to, in my own essay, I point out that Michel Barnier, the lead EU27 negotiator, has a far better understanding of what is at stake in Northern Ireland because he was EU special envoy to Northern Ireland for 5 years and dispersed hundreds of millions of euros in structural funding there. That's his background. By contrast, many of the incumbents of the Northern Ireland office or of the Secretary of Stateship for Northern Ireland don't seem to know a great deal about it. And that would include the present incumbent with whom I'm slightly acquainted. Karen Bradley must have been so focused on her tax accountancy management studies during her first 30 years on this earth, not to notice in those 30 years that the television was alive with people being blown up and shot every night, as were the newspapers that presumably she didn't read. Because recently, in an interview with the House of Commons magazine, she freely admitted that on taking the job, she didn't know that in Northern Ireland, people vote along confessional lines. And then, despite the fact that David Cameron, as Prime Minister, when he delivered the Savile report or commented on it, said he apologised in the House of Commons for people who'd been murdered effectively on Bloody Sunday, she recently said, oh, well, all the people who were shot by the police and by the army, they were just doing their duty and obeying orders. So that was all fine. She immediately, of course, had to apologise when people pointed out that Cameron had actually apologised for Bloody Sunday. Now, leading Brexiteers, to whom I just want to come on for a little bit, basically have a, many of them, as we can see, a pastiche grasp of the history of England. Some of them indeed write it themselves in a sort of faux Churchillian manner. And given that that's their sort of mentality in a way, they very easily succumb to the idea that the Irish, and not 27 EU countries, are playing the old game of taking advantage of England's internal difficulties. Incidentally, that ambition was first coined by Daniel O'Connell as far back as 1856. And the other thing about the Brexiteers, which of course were the obvious thing about the Brexiteers, as indeed about so many European populist leaders, is of course that these are elite tribunes of the people. You can tell because they use fancy words like folderol, like Mr. Mogg in Parliament today, or he can come out like Johnson with a bit of few lines of Latin or Greek. These are elite figures who are now tribunes of the people. Actually, it's got plenty of continental equivalents. I mean, think of the AfD leader in Germany, the Countess, the Duchess of Oldenburg, Beatrix von Storch, the great voice of the people in Germany. I could go through a lot of other ones and a lot of other populist movements as well. Anyway, these people very quickly fall into all sorts of national stereotypical type traps, and I'm thinking of Johnson, of Mr. Mogg, of IDS and the whole of the rest of them when they talk about Ireland. And naturally, these things are replicated in British right-wing newspapers. Now, why would they actually think very deeply, one must ask themselves, about anything as parochial as Ireland, north or south? Because their minds are suffused with dreams, big dreams, that they're going to set up an Anglosphere, whatever that is, that the UK will become a European Singapore, or it will become an updated buccaneering Britannia, courtesy of Donald Trump and Xi Jinping. This is a much more attractive thing to think about than thinking about the parochial problems of South Armagh or whatever. Now, Brexit is not just a process, though it undoubtedly is, but, as I indicated by referring to Alan Sked, it's a case of escalatory demands, because Alan's views about the EU were actually quite temperate, I seem to remember. It's a series of escalatory demands in which the absolutism of a few ideologues or true believers has become the creed of a populist mass movement, extending from the disintegrating UKIP via the insurgent 5 weeks old party Brexit into the Conservative Party quite deeply, and then out again into parts of Labour. I mean, where I live in Vauxhall, my local MP, Kate Hoey,
she's ours too, right?
Appeared on the little fishing boat that turned up outside the House of Commons in the Thames, where her and Farage, her friend Farage, threw dead fish into the river for some reason. I never quite got that. But she also always sits with the DUP 10 in the House of Commons, if you ever look at the Parliament channel, as I do obsessively. Mm. And basically, I can't vote Labour because voting for her would be a vote for the DUP, where I live. That's what she is. She's not a Labour Party member. She's a member of the DUP. So that's not on. Anyway, I've got that off my chest now. This noisy movement, of course, and I'm going back to when UKIP started, in turn accounts for Cameron's decision to hold the referendum in the first place in 2016 and the rabbit in the headlights procrastination that we've seen for the last 3 years with Theresa May. She's been trying, perhaps honourably, to avoid damaging the UK economy, not just for one generation, but maybe for several. And she wants, because she's a classic securocrat, it's her special subject, almost like an A-level, she doesn't want to damage the peace process in Northern Ireland. But at the same time, she has to maintain, and has had to maintain, red lines, as they're called, to appease her own vociferous conservative hardliners on the backbenches, and, of course, the DUP 10, who are essential to the survival of her entire government. Now, this brings me to two odd comparisons, which you might like or you might not. Over the last 30 years, Ireland has become a modern, progressive member of the EU, deftly maximising its soft power, not just in Brussels, but in a wider range of international institutions and NGOs, which have got many Irish people working in them. With 40 million Irish heritage people in the US, many of them in quite powerful positions, the Irish also have as powerful a voice in Washington as the alleged special relationship guarantees the UK, and which, as Mick quite rightly said, you saw being brutally demonstrated during Speaker Pelosi's visit to London and Belfast. She sat down with some of the more extreme Brexiteers and just said to them, just get real here, because if you mess up that peace process, no trade deal. By the way, I didn't mention it because it was too complicated earlier on, but if you look at the way that Trump has restructured NAFTA into UMSCA, in the small print, Mexico and Canada cannot do separate trade deals with China, but of course the Brexit boys want to do trade deals with China and with the US. But there's going to be a little problem in the small print on that one when they get round to it. That's just a technical detail.
Big one.
So put simply, Ireland, I think, is comfortable in its own European skin, and it has many friends. Until recently, they included us. Because, of course, the UK and Ireland usually lined up together in defending low corporation taxes and advocating deregulation against a more sort of dirigist southern European bloc. So they were all on the same side. And Ireland will actually continue to be a member of what's called the Hanseatic League, opposing Mr. Macron in the EU in future. Now, in return, the EU have demonstrated solidarity with Dublin throughout the Brexit negotiations. The English don't actually seem to even imagine, again, there's that word imagine, that the Troubles were beamed all over European TV for 30 years. And I can tell you about that because I was living in Germany for half of the 1980s, and night after night, you know, I'd have to explain to the people I was living with why the hell there were people being shot dead or blown up in this funny little place. And their sympathies were not, on the whole, with the English government, with the British government. And we seem to not realise that the Europeans have actually got an interest in Northern Ireland. And Adrian Gwelka's essay in this pamphlet is particularly good, by the way, on how after the end of the Cold War, both the EU and the US became heavily invested in resolving not just that conflict, but of course the Israeli-Palestinian peace process and ending apartheid in South Africa. There were sort of three things that they got into. Now, EU support for Ireland also reflects the fact that after the 2008 financial crash, Ireland put its hands up to reckless behaviour, you know, basically property speculation, and having put its hands up, it dutifully swallowed its austerity medicine. So it's not like Athens or somewhere where there were riots in the streets about austerity. The Irish just got down to it, said, look, we brought this on ourselves and we're going to have to just, you know, slim down and get through this, which they have done. But of course, it also, the support for Ireland also reflects another thing. I think I read somewhere that the 19 smallest, the Brexiteers love telling you that the 19 smallest EU nations are about the size of the British economy. But that's not the point. When the smaller nations look at Ireland in relation to the EU, they think, well, if the EU shafts the Irish, what's to stop them doing that with me in Latvia? And just think about Latvia and Russia as two terms. So if they see a small country getting done over, why wouldn't it happen again? And of course, the EU in general is very, very concerned to say that it isn't just a Franco-German cartel, you know, the big boys, that all the small countries, the smaller countries, have actually got a real voice. That's it. That's very much part of what's going on there. Now, speaking of Russia, and I'm coming on to my second weird comparison, it seems to me that the emergence of English nationalism from within a union, which many regard as an elite project, in England at least, rather resembles that of Russian nationalism after they were no longer obliged by their own Soviet communist ruling elite to extravagantly celebrate the charming folkways of Kazakhs and Uzbeks. I think that's very much what's going on, that the precious union is an elite project. You know, the Queen likes to go up to Balmoral in the summer and play Scottish. I don't think many people actually in England also feel that. So what I'm sort of saying, to reduce it to football slogans, is that We've now got Engerland, Engerland, echoing Rossia, Rossia. And, of course, there's a similar uptick in hostility towards foreigners in the streets of both Moscow, London and other English cities. But there's another paradox, which I just alluded to, in the precious union itself. In my contribution, I mention a joint Cardiff and Edinburgh University study, which reported, and I quote, that clear majorities of English conservatives would support Scottish independence, 79% they found, or the collapse of the Northern Ireland peace process, 75%, as the price of a proper Brexit. That's what the English actually think. Another King's College London study showed widespread English indifference towards Irish unification. You know, only 19% of people said, yeah, we don't mind that at all, go for it. But a big chunk of people said they couldn't care less, and then a much smaller number of people opposed it. And, of course, it gets worse. Now, I've spent a lot of the time in the last 7 years running a business in the city where people are, as you can see, not reticent in voicing their opinions. Many of these people like Scotland as a place to go fishing and shooting once a year. The richer ones own a house or an estate up there where they go and play being Scottish. Now, whether I'm talking about bank analysts or hedge fund bosses, many of them would actually quite explicitly say to you that they want London to become like Singapore, with everything outside the M25 reduced to the equivalent of Malaysia. This is despite the fact that people in the future English Malaysia, the hinterlands, would obviously deeply resent London even more than they do now, for I don't on the whole like historical parallels, but there is one going on here which I can readily think of. There is massive regional antagonism in this country, which actually reminds me basically of the antagonism towards Red Berlin, Red Madrid, Red Vienna in the 1920s and 30s, except the resentment just a bit out there is towards London as a multicultural bastion of Remain rather than of Stalinism. That's actually what's going on here. And if you look at the map, if I had a map to show you of the Brexit vote, you would see London sticks out like a sore thumb. And I suspect after tomorrow, it's going to look like even more of a sore thumb. Now, Mick referred to civil services in Dublin and London, and I'm going to do a bit of that too. The British government's strategy throughout the Brexit negotiation was based on a superiority complex about its Rolls-Royce civil service, and, of course, the old tactic of divide and rule, which would see Italian winemakers or German car manufacturers pressure their governments into softening the terms. Hello, do you not read German newspapers? One glance at how the VW Audi emissions crisis has put the German car makers in what the Germans would call the Hundehüter, the doghouse, with the government, or how Merkel completely ignored 6,500 big German businesses which trade with Russia when she went ahead and imposed sanctions on Russia. They said, oh, Chancellor, don't do that. We've got, you know, Deutsche Bahn, everything there. No way she went and did it. So the idea that, which is particularly David Davis's problem when he was Brexit Secretary, that these big companies would somehow get their governments to soften it up with the British was always going to be a delusion. Now, why didn't they look at a damn German newspaper? Why didn't the British Embassy in Berlin not report that back to them? Why did nobody read it? This is something that, you know, one ought to be really concerned about. Naturally, of course, the Brexiter explanation for failure was that, like the judges, enemies of the people, according to the Daily Mail, the civil servants were traitors bent on frustrating a proper Brexit. And inevitably, the cunning Juncker and Tusk were accused of using Ireland as a kind of wedge of their own, with Leo Varadkar, or the Indian, as IDS once called him, as their pawn. Now, May's botched 2017 election, which Mick's talked about, also made her government fatefully dependent on a single Northern Irish party, the populist DUP, which actually, interestingly, it was founded in 1971, which was a year before the foundation of the Front National, I seem to remember. And it was a populist party. I remember as a teenager watching Northern Irish politicians, and at one point they were all sort of posh landowners, captain this or colonel that, because they'd fought in the war. And then, bingo, there were these rather rough people came up in their midst, some of whom, the clergymen, resembled Sunni imams in the sense of having a, like a garage mosque, a sort of church of one, like Ian Paisley and so forth. So it was a very weird thing, which you suddenly had to comprehend. Now, as Mick said, this undermined the idea that the dependence on the DUP undermined the idea that the UK government was an honest broker in Northern Ireland, where for quite separate reasons, power sharing, of course, collapsed, notably the Cash for Ash scandal, which I won't explain to you. They and their allies in the conservative hard right have consistently frustrated the most obvious rational solution to the complex border problem, namely that the UK remains in the customs union, or failing that, that Northern Ireland remains in it on its own with the Republic. So we're left with an Ireland which, as Paul Gillespie shows in his essay, has basically, for some time, it's escaped the kind of hyphenated fixation or obsession with its neighbour, which is the sort of thing that governs, say, relations between India and Pakistan. They're almost sort of locked into each other and can't quite think of something else. The Irish have managed to stop thinking about us, and their minds are turned outwards. I think that's the big thing. Meanwhile, the neighbour, of course, descends into its own solipsistic hell. And there's another instalment. I'm not even sure by now the Prime Minister hasn't resigned.
She hasn't.
She hasn't, no. We're all looking, waiting. I don't think she's going to resign, actually, tonight. I don't think she will. She is tougher than that, and I think she'll go on at least to when Trump's here. Now, we know that many Brexiters don't care about the UK's traditional union or its non-elected democratic institutions, because, of course, democracy involves far more than simply casting a vote. It involves a whole series of non-elected ambient institutions, a free press, judicial impartiality, a neutral civil service, etc., etc. It's not just about, I voted, therefore I must get my way. Nor do, of course, appeals to economic self-interest matter much either. Northern Ireland, as one of the contributors points out, costs much more to subsidise than UK membership of the EU each year. It's significantly more. Voters in the Welsh Valleys, one of the most deprived parts of the UK, know that the EU pays Wales £690 million a year in structural subsidies. But they still voted Brexit, chiefly on the grounds, they will tell you, that they couldn't get much poorer. And you will find that mentality in the very deprived areas of some of the decayed coastal towns of this country, in parts of the old post-industrial north. People say, well, our lives are such shit. So what? How's it going to get worse? Well, of course, they don't. You know, they'll eat chips, as Mick said, Sammy Wilson advised. Now, the other disturbing thing that one is witnessing is that, as in elsewhere in Europe, of course, the Conservatives are becoming more porous towards the populist right by the day, and some of them may be tempted down the Sebastian Kurz route of entering into a coalition with them in order basically to smother them, or at least to expose their inadequacies by make them actually responsible for something. And there is already talk in some quarters in the Conservative Party of, you know, some sort of electoral pact or even a coalition maybe with a party that's 5 weeks old, were it to stand in elections and do very well, which it may well do. Now, a new Brexity Conservative leader will, of course, confront exactly the same resolute EU27, I predict, and the same adverse Commons arithmetic when they've finished their long holiday and come back to the Commons in October. So really, actually, at the end of this, I can't exude any rays of sunshine whatsoever as I contemplate the ongoing political and institutional decay of a once serious country, which will probably soon be governed not just by ex-journalistic hacks who have a deplorable record in government, there's several of them already in the government, but probably soon ex-hacks and comedians. In fact, I have a horrible nightmare one day that we'll have sort of Prime Minister Piers Morgan or somebody. You know, they're part of the ongoing celebritisation of politics. You know, we've seen it with Zelensky in Ukraine and Grillo in Italy. I mean, why not Piers Morgan as Prime Minister? Anyway, I think I've said enough now, really.
Okay.
But I am very concerned about the harm this will do in the long term to Anglo-Irish relations. I don't think that's going to be very easy to fix. Mm. I'll stop there, Mick.
Okay, thanks very much, Mike. Very good.
Okay, we've got a fair bit of time for some questions. I hope there's going to be a few. I hope a bit of provocation. Let's start with a gentleman who can say who you are and look forward to your question.
Thank you. The name's Ewan Grant. I'm a former customs officer who's worked on the European VAT system, which I realise is very much related to very serious crime. Very political crime and a lot of money. And certainly the technical aspects of the border are solvable and workable. But as you pointed out, I mean, that is not really the point. I did once work with a colleague who, like me, was a Scot, but he was of Irish Catholic origin. And he once said to me, there'll be no peace in Northern Ireland until the Protestants are thrown out. Oh, how common is that among the Irish Catholic population of the North and the South? I was once warned by a Northern Irish Catholic that I might be in danger because I'd criticized a priest. And she said, I'm worried that the Catholic Church will pass your name and address to the IRA. Oh, I don't think you're giving an entirely balanced view of the fears that, because remember, Sinn Féin is not just a populist party, if indeed it is also a murderous party. And if one of your relatives had been killed, you might have a different view, Mr. Bowen.
Okay, thanks very much. We're going to take some other contributions too. Let's go around. Anybody else? Yes, hi.
Excuse me, thank you. But like his comments like that, which just boggle the mind, the modern Irish person cannot think that way about Sinn Féin. They're a modern social democratic party that operates on both sides of the border and behave perfectly normally. It's completely ridiculous, some of the rhetoric that is parroted in the British media about Sinn Féin, including from the kind of broadcast journalists in the UK who say things like, and I mean the right-wing broadcast journalists particularly, who talk about Leo Varadkar being, you know, in any way deferent to Sinn Féin. Like, you couldn't pick two more diametrically opposed political parties than Fine Gael and Sinn Féin.
Yeah.
But, like, it's honestly, it boggles the mind, and I just want your thoughts on this.
My mind is boggled, too. My mind has been boggled since June 2016. I lived, my wife and I lived in Northern Ireland with a perfectly obvious English accent for 22 years, and yes, there was a sense of fear and trepidation, but never once because I was an English person, to be perfectly honest. And yes, there was deep sectarianism on both sides, and you know, that was part of the tragedy and part of the cause of the troubles within Northern Ireland. However, I don't quite recognise the picture you're painting of what would happen. And by the way, the relationship between the Catholic Church and the IRA was a very problematic one. It wasn't that symbiotic relationship you're talking about. In fact, the Catholic Church became a crucial part of the peace process. And the truth of the matter is, we've got to get to where we are today and not where we were, you know, back at the height of the troubles in the 70s and the 1980s, where some pretty awful things were done. Nobody doubts that for a second. Assassinations, killing of policemen, killing of civilians. And non-warning bombs in certain instances, and I went to a number of funerals of my students and indeed colleagues at Queen's University to know that the IRA was not exactly at that stage a social democratic organization. Nonetheless, the question is, we had to get to the peace process. That's what we had to get to. We had to negotiate. I mean, when I was there, my wife was there, my friends were there, Obviously, it involved what you might call compromise or debates with people who didn't necessarily like, who'd been involved in political military activities you may not have liked. But the point was, you would never have got that peace process without the engagement. And I'd also say today, I don't quite know how I characterize Sinn Féin politically, but I think it's more social democratic than anything else. And I agree with your point there. The gun has been taken out of politics. The decommissioning has happened. Sinn Féin has become a mass political party, or a more serious political party, without the gun. You know, the old argument that you could have the Armalite in one hand and the ballot box in another was a contradiction in terms. And I think people like Adams and others and senior members of Sinn Féin, stroke IRA, whatever you want to call them, I think came to that recognition and that conclusion. And then they had to find the partners, first in the SDLP, with the very great John Hume, who's never got enough credit for what happened, with some very great people from the south of Ireland, and indeed from the European Union, and indeed from the United States, to bring everybody into that process to create this rather remarkable and ambiguous peace process, as you said. I mean, it's, ambiguity doesn't even begin to describe the Good Friday Agreement. But you needed that ambiguity to get the agreement. Everybody thought they were getting something out of that agreement. So we are now 20 years on, and that's where I'm saying. We're 20 years on, and the importance of keeping Sinn Féin, you know, within the framework of democratic politics and participating and winning elections on their program. That seems to me the absolutely crucial part of where we are today.
I mean, surely one of the big...
Do you want to use that? Bring it up to you, so just be easier.
One of the big problems of Theresa May's premiership for the last 3 years has been, as I said, that because of support from the DUP, that she's had only very episodic, shall we say, talks with other parties in Northern Ireland, and, of course, with opposition parties in Scotland and indeed here. I mean, the talks with Labour about this crisis started 7 weeks ago and then ended. So the government hasn't exactly... I mean, she was absolutely convinced she was going to get this deal through somehow with the Conservatives and the DUP, and it all just unravelled. And in desperation, she went for Plan B, and, of course, it was too late. So that's that. I mean, I do think, actually, you talked about religion. I mean, one of the most boring books I think I've read in my life, a lifetime of boring books, was one about religion and modern populist movements, a very obscure book, which is a pretty underplayed theme. And I think just I'd make one comment about the Brexit boys, that I certainly know of notorious media-tart clerics who regard Brexit as a replay of the English Reformation. No, seriously, they really do. But that sits very uncomfortably with the fact that certainly the inner editorial hierarchy of one very prominent conservative newspaper, I won't go any further, consists of rabid Catholics. The most Brexity newspaper in the British press is actually dominated by some pretty heavy-duty Catholics.
Gosh.
So the two things don't, in a way... Yeah, the Telegraph, obviously, both Telegraphs. Well, the Barclay brothers are very committed Catholics who own the Telegraph, as was Conrad Black, of course. Yeah, a whole lot of them. Oh, it's much way beyond him. It's Tim Stanley. It's a whole crowd of them in there, like a nest. So you have this...
I should point out English Catholics are rather different to Irish.
This sort of paradox that on the one hand you have evangelical clergy like Giles Fraser, who's a vicar up the road from me, who are fervent Brexiteers, and then the other hand you've got these sort of posh English Catholics who are also fervent. One day someone will write something rather interesting about it, but it won't be me.
Yeah, sure. Hi. Well, serious questions. Yeah, please. Yeah, thanks. Well, yeah, use that phone, yeah, thanks.
Thank you. My question is on how you think the backstop, if it were to come into force, would affect the Good Friday Agreement. Because on the one hand, you know, I can imagine Protestant business support for it would make Northern Ireland one of the most attractive places in the UK to do business. But on the other hand, it would create a border between Great Britain and Northern Ireland. Mm. It does require at least a movement certificate in order to move goods from Great Britain to Northern Ireland, and probably a lot more. It has a lot of details that are yet to be spelled out, but it seems to me that even if you accepted it was the best solution possible to protect the peace process, it still does have an impact in that it does mean that Great Britain and Northern Ireland will have a border as it stands.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask what.
Okay.
It's not really going to be technical, but it is, of course, symbolic.
Yeah. Okay. Well, take that question. I mean, could there's another question here, and others here, or lady here. Yeah. Please. Yeah. 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 Anybody. I don't mind. Sorry. Bring it back to you.
Just a brief update. Andrea Leadsom's just resigned. It may please you to know.
Oh my goodness me!
Good heavens!
Tragedy.
How will we cope? I appreciated your point with respect to the fact that Ireland has evolved into a much more outward-looking nation than it ever had done before. And I feel that process has very much been mirrored in my home nation, in Scotland. Mm-hmm. I think that the smaller countries very much are forced to look out the way it is contingent upon you to do so. Mm-hmm. And I wonder perhaps what if you might conduct a thought experiment, as it were, had it been an independence referendum for England in 2014 and not for Scotland, perhaps we might have avoided Brexit and been a very different position, and that everybody might have actually got what they wanted out of the situation. Okay. I wonder what your thoughts might be, that actually England has not realised she is not an independent nation yet and seems determined to drag the rest of us along in her wake.
Yeah.
What do you think in regards to that as a potential solution for all parties?
Okay, let's a lady here, please. Yeah. Anybody else wants to ask a question?
Can I answer that one first?
Well, let's just take one more. Right, okay. Let's take one more. Then we do another round. Yeah.
Right.
Hi. So I'm a master's student over here, and I was wondering regarding solutions. There was one that I thought worked, which was a special status, just because, of course, it's not ideal. None of them are ideal. That's why it's a tough situation. But I was thinking, what did you think about a special status?
Special status for whom?
Northern Ireland.
Mm. Yeah, okay. Well, I'll deal quickly with those, and then Michael pick up where he wants to go. On the backstop issue, well, you're quite right. I mean, you know, and this is obviously part of DUP point, isn't it? Essentially, that if you have a backstop, which is just incorporates six counties, Northern Ireland itself, you then draw the border down the Irish Sea, as they would call it, and therefore that's separating Northern Ireland from the rest of the United Kingdom. Now, from a purely political point of view, given unionist sensitivities on this, because after all, they've been fighting for over 200 years to remain British, to remain part of the United Kingdom, this is politically completely unacceptable. And the DUP have been very clear on that. So I suppose the next phase in that really, and I can see why they would be worried. I mean, I'm not entirely, you know, insensitive to their concerns and their worries. I'm not trying to paint them, you know, colour on noir. I mean, it's not quite so simple. You've got to explain people's assumptions, where they've come from. They go back First World War. They go back to the formation of the Ulster Volunteer Force. They go back to their contribution in two wars. I'm not anti, you know, Protestant. Believe me for one minute, I'm not. I understand their fears. I was only trying to explain where those fears, you've got to explain where those fears come from. But still, it leaves us in an impasse when we come to try and find a solution out of this. I suppose the only way forward then would be then to extend the whole of the backstop, you know, to the whole of the United Kingdom. But of course, you know what then happened, you know, in other words, the whole of the UK, and that of course was backstop plus. You then have to extend it, but then of course, that means you are full-time complete members now of a customs union, which of course goes fundamentally against what Brexit is trying to design to do, which is to make sure we don't have a customs union.
I'm sure it's an axis
of convenience, largely, although they still have certain views about the European Union, which they share in common. And let's be perfectly honest, they're pretty conservative, too, on certain social and political issues as well. DUP is a deeply conservative party. I mean, you won't actually, somebody's talking about the evolution of Irish society, and I started living there in 72, and the changes that I saw between 72 and even when I left in the 1990s were dramatic, not only about, you know, change of rural to urban, more outward going, and look at the votes on gay marriage and all sorts of other things, which, and it's not just Dublin either, you know, it's not just a Dublin-based thing. You need the weakening of the Catholic Church. I mean, what is quite, I find, you know, extraordinary, and in a sense, it says something about the depth and strength of unionist and Protestant feeling, which you've got to understand. I mean, I really think this is important for us, not to kind of, provide parody pictures of people, is the in a way that the conservatism has not changed. I mean, this is really quite remarkable. You know, all this talk, all the things that are happening in the South makes South more modern liberal country. The old image, of course, was the South was deeply conservative, deeply rude, fundamentally backward, and the North was this modern, industrial, future-looking economy. Now, the whole thing has been reversed. And I think this is a remarkable shift. Where I think this, but there's a larger question here, and I'll hand over to you, Michael. There is a larger question here, whether or not this whole process, which is undergoing at the moment, which we've been talking about, actually, it might be a logical outcome over years, given the changing demographics in the North, bluntly. Secondly, this, the Republic of Ireland looks increasingly economically attractive to business people in the North. You can, if you can detoxify the Irish question, which the Brexit vote is doing the opposite, you may come to a conclusion that it's quite possible. And Sinn Féin is saying this, by the way, and this is why I say Sinn Féin, I think, could be the long-term winners of this. They're actually saying, very smart guys, by the way, in Sinn Féin. They're kind of saying, well, give it a few years, Brexit is going to drive Northern Ireland out of the Union because it's such a problem. And that, you know, the, come into my parlour. I don't want to kind of sound crazy, but there is this sense that an attractive South, a more plural South would increasingly appeal, not just to nationalists in the North, but to Protestant businessmen, Protestant middle classes in the North. And that may therefore be the long-term evolution. I don't know if it's going to happen because people have been talking about that for years. But I think that might be, that I think is what Sinn Féin is strategically thinking about, I think, moving forward. I don't know what you think about that, Michael.
Well, I think that there's another problem going on here, which is that the DUP gets constant exposure in and on our media all the time. I mean, you see them, you know, constantly.
Over here.
Yes, intimately familiar with them. And there is a type of... very organized.
Yeah, my, use your microphone.
Sorry,
people can't hear.
There is also a very organized pro-unionist lobby, which is based in a particular think tank in London, and which is very successful in getting their view over in the media. Now, by contrast, being just a pretty normal consumer of the media, I would have a very hard job actually giving you a good explanation or a convincing explanation of what any of the other political positions of the other political parties, including Sinn Féin, actually, or the Alliance or whatever, in Northern Ireland are. I just don't simply know. And then this, of course, raises a much wider point about how the EU has been travestied in our media for several years. Now, you know, something happened to me just before Christmas where I was watching a what seemed like a very reasonable, intelligent, elderly gentleman being interviewed for 3 minutes or 2 minutes by Laura Kunzberg on the main news. And I thought, good God, I've never heard him talk. I really suddenly thought, I've never heard this man talk. He was Jean-Claude Juncker, the president of the European Commission. And I swear to God, I'd been, you know, I'm pretty big consumer of the news, I'd never seen this man being interviewed. This just struck me as incredible. And of course, then he's pilloried and caricatured as drunker and all the rest of it in the tabloid newspapers, you know, some silly old fool falling around drunk. This is a disgrace. Now, to come back to your question, I find any form of hypothetical or virtual history incredibly difficult. The one time I ever tried to write it was a complete disaster. It really was a disaster. Never again. But I do think that, yes, there is obviously an English problem, and there have been people who've suggested, you know, quite plausibly maybe, taking the opportunity of the dereliction and repair of Westminster to move the Parliament somewhere roughly into the middle of the country. That might be quite a good idea, or at least, although the idea of the EU Parliament rotating isn't a good precedent, but to put it somewhere else for a bit, that's good, and to break down this intense concentration of our institutions all around us just here. That's one point. And then another thing I've certainly come across put forward by Robert Salisbury struck me as quite a good suggestion, which is to create an English Parliament and then to just retain what you might call a federal Parliament to handle defence and foreign policy. You, by the way, you don't get as conservative as Robert Salisbury ever. You couldn't get to the right of him. But, I mean, that struck me as quite an inventive solution to this problem. I mean, the snag is that this is, you know, stripped of stripped of Scotland, Northern Ireland, and, well, the Welsh, we won't be stripped of the Welsh because I don't believe it's feasible, that. But England in itself is a big place. And when people have been offered devolved government in England, they've either rejected it or sort of, I don't know, elected a rabbit or something as the mayor. You know, they're completely contemptuous of that notion. So there is a problem with pushing institutions down to a regional level. Although I actually think that creation of city mayors has been a pretty successful thing. I mean, I don't know much about Liverpool or Manchester or whatever, or Birmingham, but it does seem to me to be quite a... Yeah, okay, it's working on in the north. But I come back to this point that I made earlier on, that when I occasionally peruse articles or read books written by Scots or certainly Irish people about questions of ethnicity and nationality, it's on a whole level of sophistication that I don't think I've ever read by an English person. It's like we don't even have the I mean, maybe I'm just ignorant. It could be the case because I'm not a historian of Britain, obviously, but or Ireland. But it does strike me there's this terrible disparity in the two things. I mean, I don't think we've actually even addressed this.
Yeah.
England just understands that she's the only Polynesian without devils.
Yeah.
That her identity is not the default for all of the home nations.
Yeah.
You know, even, for example, silly examples like Prince William wishing the English football team well. This country, the whole country is behind you. Well, which country would that be, William? Because you're speaking really from four.
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
And these kind of things, if you say this country, there are four countries.
Yeah.
Well,
but I also think in the case of they don't even think the Irish Republic is a sort of autonomous place. That's even more worrying.
It's where the horses come from.
Yes, that's true. Yes. Yes.
Yeah, they always win the Grand National.
Perhaps without having that challenge for her own national identity, England isn't really able to define it in the same way that
the Scots. I think there's a larger. I come on to that because I think there's a larger question of the slow dissolution of the United Kingdom, and I think it was happening before Brexit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the processes of unravelling, which are to do with firstly the end of empire, the working out of that. Secondly, the decline of Protestant religion, because that was a unifying ideology of the empire, and anti-Catholic too, by the way, in the main. And thirdly, economic. And Brexit, it seems to me, comes at the end. And I think the deep irony of all this, of course, thinking about it long term as opposed to short term, and maybe that's what we've got to try and do more, is to think that Brexit, I mean, the Conservative Party is called the Conservative and Unionist Party.
Yeah.
And it's going to be one of the great ironies, of course, of history, and not one I'm necessarily looking forward to. But nonetheless, it's going to be one of the great ironies of history that a Conservative Party will be the end of the Union.
Mm.
You know, because I think it has set off forces which were already there, but they've been accelerated by this, not just in Scotland, but in Northern Ireland, and that's going to fragment. Wales, I think, will be slightly different for obvious geographical reasons. So I think that's what we're gazing down that. And that irony, of course, of a Conservative and Unionist Party, which becomes actually the cause of the end of the Union, about which many Conservatives, really in their heart of hearts, in the English, actually don't care too much. Well, whatever they may say, whatever they may say on the party card and that protecting the Union. But anyway, there's a lady here, and there was one or two others, and then there's a lady here, sorry, yeah, please.
Did we answer your questions?
We'll come back to that one. I know the one. Yes, about the special status, yeah.
Yeah.
Come on, I just want to bring up.
My name's Megan, and I'm actually a Canadian expat, living here, obviously, in the UK. And I came here tonight because I do try to follow this entire Brexit process.
Mm.
And like many of you, I'm sure I get lost, but more so. And so listening tonight, a couple of things just popped out to me. But just to address a point you just made, prior to moving here, and before this, I actually lived in Singapore, I knew there was Scotland, England, Scotland, Ireland, Wales, and the other. But I always thought of them as part of the United Kingdom, which is the brand. And so when I hear Prince William or hear someone else of that ilk say, you know, we're one nation, or then my political hat comes on and I realize what they're trying to do is basically keep the perception that I have of this united English country has been
won.
So that's just as a result of what you said. But my question was specifically, in the section of your talk where you discussed sort of when the English go up to Scotland to play Scottish, you tossed in a couple of numbers, and I'm curious about them. Because it was more, I was surprised at the seeming indifference of the English, as I'm learning to say tonight, toward the Scottish and the Irish. And I guess what I'm just wondering, was there a demographic profile of within those numbers? Because the numbers were quite shocking to me. They may be normal to everyone else. And so I just wonder if it were more young people who may not have the knowledge or the history of, you know, what has preceded in terms of the IRA and all of that. Even though I didn't live here, I certainly was aware of it. So my question is, I'm just curious of what the numbers were, like the demographic profile for the top line numbers you talked about.
Okay. Are there any other questions to go? Because we're not so. Very good question. Anything? Yeah, sorry, Jim. Yeah.
Simon.
Go for it.
Yeah, I'm Simon King. I was an academic specializing in Irish politics. I now run a political consultancy. I just want to make 2 points. First, the point about Sinn Féin, both you made it and Nick, you made it as well. I'd be a little bit careful, having had the pleasure or displeasure of meeting quite a few Sinn Féin people in the last while, lauding Sinn Féin too much.
Okay.
You describe them as a social democratic party. That's what they want to hear, for sure. But there's, I'm not sure they're quite there yet. They are as cynical as the DUP.
They certainly are.
You could argue that they're as much responsible for bringing down the Northern Ireland Executive as the DUP are. They insisted on an Irish Language Act and all sorts of kind of things to sort of
keep it out.
Ironically, Catholic farmers, if you want, for want of a better word, benefited just as much from this famed Cash for Ash scandal that Sinn Féin got so earlier than thou about. They have a sort of puppet leadership in the north of Ireland, and the party's still really
puppet
run
leadership.
Puppet, yeah. There's Michelle O'Neill, who's a sort of non-entity, really, and the party's still controlled by the IRA Army Council. The last point I'd make on Sinn Féin is that I think if they really, and they're lucky, they're on the right side of Brexit. The younger population, certainly in the South, do see them as a social democratic party. Maybe that's a good thing, and maybe that'll help them transition. I think if they were really committed, and as you were saying, Mick, they have the opportunity now to make a difference, and have done over the last couple of years, if they had taken their seats in Parliament. And I think they're really ideologically committed party.
But
I mean, De Valera, Fianna Fáil, 1933, entered the Doyle, they crossed their fingers behind their back and took the oath to the king, which they had to do that one. Sinn Féin could do it and would make a difference and would mark them out as a proper modern political party, having shed this IRA baggage.
That's just
the point I want to make about Sinn Féin.
Sure.
One other very quick point, Michael and maybe yourself would comment on.
Yeah.
Been looking at the picture of Nancy Pelosi for the last hour.
Sorry, it wasn't deliberate.
It's a very good picture.
You and Arlene, dear. I'll get Arlene faster.
Trump, what's Trump's position going to be on Northern Ireland Brexit? As far as we know, Trump supports Brexit, doesn't he?
Yes.
Trump wants a hard Brexit. That's what, you know, he thinks Theresa May should have sued the EU. Everyone, he's got an Irish voting contingent over in the US. Does Nancy Pelosi really have control over whether there's a US or UK trade agreement, or is that going to be Trump? I'd be interested to hear what you think Trump's going to do about all of this.
Well, no, thanks. I'll try and quickly, on the question of getting back to the union and your question about, one of the things that I've, over many years, I actually lived in Scotland for 5 years, then I lived in Ireland for 22, and then I lived in Wales, in Aberystwyth. For 7. So I represent the union, in my body. And by the way, my mother's family were Irish. The name is McGraw, by the way. And Mick is not accidental. So you had the Mick and the McGraths, and you kind of got the classic hybrid. But one of the things I've noticed, and I don't think you don't have to be a genius to kind of observe this, is that getting back to my original point about what I call the slow dissolution of the psychological bonds of union, over. And they haven't gone completely. The bonds that held the UK together, prosperity, industry, the Labour Party, by the way, a very important part of the unionist settlement, not to be forgotten, the empire and all the other things, that is slowly dissolving. Then we get to the assemblies and the parliaments, which Tony Blair is so keen on, to save the union. Now, whether it did or not is another question. Then we get to Brexit. And I think there is a slow dissolution going on because of the way the Brexit vote panned out. But I'd also add another thing, which is what I call my footballing analogy and flag analogy. Now, we must be very sensitive to flags. I grew up as a kid in this country where I only saw the Union Jack. Okay. Now I grow up in a country where I very rarely see the Union Jack, but I see the English flag. Yeah. And I also grew up in this country where I used to go to football matches, you'd always have what we called home internationals, which Northern Ireland, Scotland, Wales play England, and there'd always be pretty strong rivalries between all, particularly against the English, I have to say. But nonetheless, it was still there as a kind of a statement about the union. And I do feel that has got much, much weaker. Yeah, much, much weaker. And I think Brexit is simply accelerating a longer-term process. Now, there are powerful factors keeping it together, particularly the size of the English economy, and the other economies are fairly small. So I do think there's a longer-term evolution. On the Sinn Féin, I mean, social democratic, maybe the wrong word. I was only trying to make two points, Simon. I don't think there'd be disagreement about us on this. Of course it is a party which goes back to the famous election of 1917-1918, and it's always been an abstentionist party, and it's been a party which has had a connection with an armed struggle tradition, which is very deep within Irish political culture. It goes back to the famine, it goes back to the pre-famine period, it goes back to the Fenians, it goes back to the symbol of 1916. And nobody I know in Sinn Féin will not be at a 1916 rally commemorating the Easter Rebellion. So, you know, that is not exactly what you might call a classical. So I agree with you in that. And that is very deeply embedded. That is very deeply embedded in Sinn Féin. And making that distinction even sometimes between the political and the military. They don't make it themselves, by the way, either. This is quite an important thing to say. The point I was really trying to drive at, Simon, and here again, I don't think there's a great deep difference between us. It's simply the political evolution to see what has happened. We wouldn't have got where we are today. We didn't get where we are today because Sinn Féin and IRA became social democratic. We got where we are today in 1998 because they thought they could continue the struggle for Irish unification through different means and in different ways and become much more effective and gain much more political leverage over the whole of Ireland. And also because they were actually in a corner and they couldn't get out of it. And that was another part of the peace process. They were actually in a deep corner and they just couldn't get out of it. I don't think anybody was holding hands across the aisles at anybody at that particular stage in time. But it is that evolution of Sinn Féin which is so important to what I call the normalization, without sounding patronizing, the normalization of Irish politics, which has been coming back. And that is also part of that modernization of Ireland too. You know, I kind of see multiple processes going on there. You know, the declining influence of the Catholic Church, the extraordinary change in the position of women, gay people, Sinn Féin becoming a normalizing political party on the left. And I think that's where I would kind of, you know, say that's a very important part. Yeah, those are my points. Anyway, thanks very much for the good questions. Yes.
Actually, there is just one thing I would also point out to you, since you're a Canadian, that there is actually a sort of ethnic thing to do with the English-British thing. I mean, my next-door neighbour is a Jamaican woman who, like me, was born in London. She would never describe herself as English as her primary identity, whereas I would certainly describe myself as English, and I would very rarely call myself British. Now, if I walk around the corner and go to my local Kashmiri newsagent, he will be saying or an Indian one a bit further along, they will say they're British, they won't call themselves English. So there's that aspect to this too. And then the other thing, which some of you may well have picked up reading the popular print, is that some of the most fanatic Brexiteers in the Conservative Party and in the Brexit Party are South Asians, like Priti Patel, what's he called? Sankar Singham, the think tank guy, the Economist. There's a whole crowd of them who are, and that is partly because they think the EU, effectively, has encouraged a lot of European, particularly East European immigration. They don't feel anything at all to those people. They think they don't share the same cultural heritage, as it were, with the British as they do. And naturally, they see in the Brexit process perhaps an opportunity to, bring their relatives, families, dependents, etc., to this country, which, of course, would be a massive irony for the people in rural Lincolnshire who voted for Brexit on the grounds that it was going to. And this is a subject, of course, which nobody has the guts actually to address in most of our newspapers or discussions.
All you have to do is look at the curve.
Yeah.
EU immigration into this country and the curve of non-EU immigration into this country. You don't have to be bigoted or anything.
No.
To see that non-EU immigration continues to go up.
Yep.
For good economic reasons and family reunions, all totally legitimate. And clearly the decline of EU immigration is going to happen. So the irony is...
Or you can listen to what Priti Patel is telling her constituents.
Which is?
The same. She was saying, vote Brexit and there will be many more visas for you.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And this was not on the, by the way.
That's part of the argument.
And this was not on the side of the bus, by the way.
Yeah.
The bus that said we're going to get 350 million a week or whatever for the National Health Service. It didn't explain that part of the package. And I bet if the people who voted for Brexit in many parts of Britain had that actually fully explained to them, and indeed looked at the latest immigration figures into this country, which do exactly what you've just said, I think they'd be in for a bit of a shock.
The other side of that, the transatlantic pivot, certainly from the Democrats, the same
election,
this idea that you pivot towards the US and strategically adopt a more pro-business American approach.
The
US is manifestly against chain migration, so we're going to go US-centric with, as you point out, this Commonwealth tail of immigration that will replace.
Exactly.
Well, it won't. And can't.
Who were conned into voting for it, because let's face it, there is definitely a at the very bottom of the Brexit voting chain, quite a lot of people who voted for it for racist reasons.
Yeah, of course.
Who, as you say, are going to get shot.
They are.
The controlled turkeys who voted for Christmas.
Yeah.
Yeah, we haven't, and one thing we haven't talked about, I can't get rid of Nancy Pelosi now. I did try. So, on Trump and this is an important part of the debate. I think there was always an international relations of Brexit, and I put it to you like, it worked on three fundamental international assumptions, all of which I think turned out to be either untrue or completely wrong. One was that somehow or another there was a substitute for the European Union, which we would call the rest of the world, the emerging markets. India and China were just desperate for which, as you know and I know, just not the case. Secondly, there's the Commonwealth. They rediscovered the Commonwealth suddenly. Do you remember that? That was an interesting one. After 30 years of ignoring it completely, the Commonwealth came back into vogue. They suddenly found out that, the economy of Zimbabwe is actually not maybe the biggest export market in the world. I won't go into Kate Ho, but one of her interests is Zimbabwe. I've never quite worked that one out. And the other assumption was not only emerging markets, not only the Commonwealth, it was also going to be the United States.
Yeah.
It was going to ride to the rescue. Now, this was rather, as they say, this was rather bad timing, because whatever Trump may have said in favor of Brexit, he's also very much in favor of striking, as we have seen, pretty tough trade deals.
Yeah.
And he's an economic nationalist, and he's going to do everything to advance American national economic interest. That's what he said. He's never lied about this. And I don't know if you watched this whole thing about the Boeing and Bombardier in Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
4,000 good jobs. Engineering jobs with knock-on effects to the whole of the East Belfast economy and the Belfast economy. We're really almost on the edge. And this was because the Commerce Department, presumably therefore Donald Trump, was fighting for US economic interests against Bombardier and against the plane industry, the aircraft industry in Northern Ireland. And I think that tells you more about what Trump will think in the end about this. Now Boris Johnson may think that he can sit down and eat whatever he's going to eat with Donald Trump, if or when he becomes prime minister. There you go. Another irony of history, another tragedy of one.
Trump will not, I just don't see it. And by the way, Nancy Pelosi won't go there either. So you're doubly whammed, to use the phrase, you're doubly whammed by a Trump economic nationalist agenda, which isn't going to do anybody any favors except that of the United States. And secondly, you're whammed by Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats who control the House now, and who will be very tough on trade. They're tough on trade. It's not just Trump who's tough on trade. The Democrats are tough on trade, as they are supporting Mr. Trump only on one thing, China, on the China trade thing. So, you know, I mean, if you think there's a solution called the United States of America and a new special trade deal, I think you've got a long way
to go.
Also,
if you look at the recent...
Well, there you go. No, I don't think
they did. No, I don't think they did.
They didn't.
I mean, Johnson had a sort of lose speech in this pocket and a win speech in that pocket. Yeah. I mean, it was like that. He did.
At 10 past 10 in the evening, Nigel Farage said, "Damn, we've lost." I was at the LSE, and I remember we all started cheering. And then Sunderland came. Sunderland is a kind of symbolic moment. Anyway, look, I think we better bring it to an end. I'd like, firstly, thank you very much for coming along on this very nice evening. Thank you for your questions. And Michael, thank you very much for your contribution. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you.
There you go. Cheers.